The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the July 29th issue of the Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. The GOP's coronation of Trump. What happened? Donald Trump completed his unlikely takeover of the Republican Party this week, formally securing the nomination for president at a tumultuous convention in Cleveland. It was a convention unlike any in recent history, marred by inter-party division that saw just 33 of the party's 54 U.S. senators attend. A backlit rock star-like entrance by Trump in a cloud of fog with "We Are the Champions" blaring on the sound system and repeated calls to put Democratic rival Hillary Clinton in jail. On the first afternoon, proceedings were disrupted by a long shouting match between delegates after the chairman refused to hold a roll call vote on a proposal to let delegates vote their consciences. Trump's wife, Melania, then delivered a speech containing passages that were clearly plagiarized from Michelle Obama's speech at the 2008 Democratic Convention. The Trump campaign spent 36 hours denying the charges of plagiarism before Meredith McIver, a longtime staff writer in Trump's private company, took the blame. McIver said she had inadvertently included the First Lady's words after Melania had dictated parts of that earlier Obama speech to her on the phone as an example of what she generally wanted to say. Trump, who was scheduled to make his acceptance speech after the week went to press, boasted that his wife's address had gained more publicity than any in the history of politics, adding, "All press is good press." The convention's other speakers included several Republican lawmakers, a raft of minor celebrities, and four of Trump's children. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie led a faux prosecution of presumptive Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton, asking the audience, "Guilty or not guilty?" to chants of "Lock her up." Other speakers, most notably former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, raised fears over crime and attacks on the nation's police officers. "The vast majority of Americans do not feel safe," Giuliani said. Trump's son, Donald Jr., gave an impassioned defense of his father, condemning what he called our new aristocrats in Washington. House Speaker Paul Ryan, a reluctant endorser of Trump, focused his speech on the conservative agenda rather than the nominee himself. "Democracy is a series of choices," he said. "We Republicans have made our choice." What the editorial said. "The Republican Party faithful have good reason to be anxious," said the Tampa Bay Times. "Trump has shown no evidence he's temperamentally fit to be president. The failed insurrection over the convention rules, along with the absence of major GOP figures such as popular Ohio Governor John Kasich, showed that the party remains badly divided. Trump's decision to tap Indiana Governor Mike Pence as his running mate might sway some anti-Trumpers, because Pence appeals to physical conservatives and evangelicals. But voters need better reasons than an acceptable running mate and disgust for an opponent when they select the next president. The irony is that most of the country beyond Washington, the GOP is remarkably healthy," said the Wall Street Journal. "The party controls 31 state houses and the most state legislative seats since the 1920s. Trump clearly believes he can win the White House by sowing racial division and turning out white voters, but that's a tough ask, given Mitt Romney won 59% of whites in 2012 and still lost. Even if Trump's strategy works, the resulting alienation among non-whites could damage Republicans for years. What the columnist said. The most compelling case for voting Trump is very simple, said William McGurn in the Wall Street Journal. The alternative is President Hillary Clinton. She'd appoint far-left justices to the Supreme Court, give America a culture war on steroids, and continue the taxes and spending and regulation and weak foreign policy of the Obama years. Trump is a huge risk, but Clinton offers several certainties, none of them good for conservatives. Melania's plagiarism debacle tells us a lot about what sort of president Trump would be, said Josh Barrow in BusinessInsider.com. The fact that his poorly staffed, chaotic campaign let this boneheaded screw-up happen makes a mockery of his claim that he hires the best people. His campaign then made the obviously false claim there was no plagiarism, keeping the story running for 3 days. If you're too inept to run a presidential campaign, you're too inept to run a country. Even more troubling was the focus on Trump's convention speakers on violence and bloodshed, said Josh Marshall in TalkingPointsMemo.com. Three of the speakers were parents whose children had been killed by illegal immigrants, a crass move to whip up outrage and fear about the brown menace. Several other unhinged speakers called for Clinton to be imprisoned over Benghazi and other supposed crimes. Jailing the opposition party's leader is what happens in Russia or Latin America, not the United States. This is not a path we've ever gone down. If Trump loses in November, the GOP may well descend into civil war, with pro-Trump and anti-Trump factions fighting for control, said Rehan Salam in Slate.com. But that doesn't mean Republicans will never recover. People always overestimate the long-term consequences of sweeping political movements and election results. If Clinton wins, something will inevitably go wrong on her watch, and Republicans will rally together to blame her. The GOP will come back stronger sooner than you think. The controversy of the week, Ginsburg, a Supreme Court justice's ill-advised attack on Trump. No wonder they call her Notorious RBG, said Seth Lipsky in NYPost.com. At 83, Ruth Bader Ginsburg is the oldest justice on the Supreme Court. But age hasn't kept the liberal icon from launching a vigorous and unhinged assault on Donald Trump that makes a mockery of judicial neutrality. In 3 separate interviews, Ginsburg said that she didn't even want to think about the possibility of the Republican nominee winning in November, calling Trump a faker with no consistency, who says whatever comes into his head at the moment. She added that her late husband would have suggested that they move to New Zealand in the event of a Trump victory. Ginsburg has now expressed regret for these comments, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial, calling them ill-advised, but some songs can't be unsung. The Federal Code of Judicial Ethics forbids judges from taking sides in elections, and Ginsburg's blatant partisanship raises questions about her continuing capacity to serve as a judge. Ginsburg has nothing to apologize for, said Erwin Chemerinsky in the Los Angeles Times. The Judicial Code of Ethics only applies to lower court judges, and Ginsburg is hardly the first Supreme Court justice to stick her nose into politics. On election night 2000, Sandra Day O'Connor declared at a party that it was terrible that Al Gore appeared to be headed to victory before joining in the nakedly partisan Bush v. Gore decision that handed the presidency to George W. Bush. Justice Antonin Scalia later went duck hunting with Vice President Dick Cheney, but refused to then recuse himself from cases directly involving Cheney and the Bush administration. Let's not get hung up on the myth of judicial neutrality, said Noah Feldman in BloombergView.com. By now, it should be obvious to all that justices decide hard cases in constitutional law, such as abortion rights and affirmative action, based on their own ideology and moral values, not abstract principle. The court isn't harmed by Ginsburg acknowledging that she's worried by Trump and what he stands for. Don't be so sure of that, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. Our institutions are held together less by rules than by norms, unwritten standards that rule out certain kinds of behavior on ethical grounds. One of those important norms is that Supreme Court justices, who function as the ultimate arbiters of the Constitution and our most heated national disputes, should maintain some distance from partisan politics. Granted, Ginsburg's intervention into a political campaign is not the first or last violation of a norm. Bush v. Gore, a grotesque exercise in pure partisanship, was by far a more egregious violation. But Ginsburg's decision to butt into a presidential election does suggest that the thin boundary between the justices and politics is disappearing, something that bodes ill for our republic. Ginsburg's comments were admittedly explosive, unprecedented, and unethical, said Mark Stern in Slate.com. But she has a good reason for making them. Trump, an unhinged authoritarian and xenophobic bigot who's vowed to curtail free speech and bring back torture, poses an unparalleled threat to our country. Ginsburg has decided to sacrifice some of her reputation and prestige to send as clear a warning signal about Trump as she possibly can. Maybe so, said Fred Hyatt in WashingtonPost.com. But if Trump does win, we're going to need a strong, respected, and independent judicial branch that has the standing to rein in his inevitable assault on the Constitution and the separation of powers. Can our system survive a Trump presidency? Ginsburg's brief bout of Trump derangement syndrome is not a good omen. It was a good week for planning ahead after Dallas-based investor Shannon Burchett purchased the domain name TrumpPence2016.com for $10 in April. I made some guesses, and I guess I was right, said Burchett, who is anticipating a six-figure valuation. And it was a good week for creative excuses after Republican officials opposed to Donald Trump explained why they failed to show up at the GOP's national convention. I've got to mow my lawn, said Arizona Senator Jeff Flake. Nebraska Senator Ben Sasse said he was taking his kids to watch some dumpster fires across the state. And it was a good week for rote memorization after Thai computer programmer Komol Panisoforlet, 31, became the world's third highest-ranked Scrabble player despite not speaking English. Panisoforlet spends 6 hours a day memorizing the dictionary. But it was a bad week for lunch breaks after a Silicon Valley startup called Nutrobox implemented a 36-hour starvation period in which employees eat nothing from Monday night until Wednesday morning to boost focus and concentration. We're actually super productive on Tuesdays, said CEO Jeffrey Wu. It was a bad week for crooks with smartphones after the Manchester, New Hampshire Police Department announced it had found one of the rarest Pokemon Go characters, Charizard, in its headquarters, and invited a list of 500 people to catch it. All 500 are wanted fugitives. And it was a bad week for NIMBYism after a developer blocked from building a hotel along Malibu's famous coast decided to turn the land into an exclusive cemetery. It's freaking ghoulish, one resident complained. On the briefing page, Muslims in America. Islam in the U.S. has a long, rich history, but fears of terrorism complicate the future. How many Americans are Muslims? The Pew Research Center estimates that 3.3 million Muslims live in the U.S., which makes Islam the nation's third largest faith, behind Christianity and Judaism. It's a diverse population, primarily divided among African Americans, South Asians, and Arabs, and a well-educated one. About 40% of U.S. Muslims hold college degrees, as opposed to 29% of Americans overall. Though Muslims represent 1% of the population, they account for 10% of the nation's physicians, and have included such distinguished figures as boxer Muhammad Ali, urban architect Fazlur Khan, and cardiothoracic surgeon and TV personality Mehmet Oz. But since the September 11 attacks, American Muslims have been widely viewed with suspicion, which has intensified with the rise of ISIS and terrorist attacks in San Bernardino, Orlando, and Europe. American Muslims resent being blamed for the horrific acts of a few extremists. Muslims are not the other, said Purdue University professor Suad Abdul Kabir. We're Americans whose history begins with the history of the country. When did Islam first come to America? The earliest known Muslim to appear on the continent was a Moroccan slave, Estevanico, who was shipwrecked with Spaniards off present-day Galveston, Texas in 1528 and helped explore the American Southwest. As many as 30% of Africans enslaved in the U.S. were Muslim. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, Muslim immigrants arrived from Turkey, Syria, and Lebanon, largely settling in the Midwest. Later waves came from Bosnia, Albania, and other parts of Europe. In the 1960s, the Muslim population began to swell as the government lifted immigration quotas, and many African Americans began converting to Islam. Muslim immigration surged at century's end. 45% of today's Muslim Americans arrived after 1990. Between 1994 and 2011, the number of U.S. mosques more than doubled, from 962 to 2,106. How well have Muslims fit in? A 2011 Pew survey found them highly assimilated into American society and largely content with their lives. More than 80% of U.S. Muslims expressed satisfaction with life in America, and 63% said they felt no conflict between being a devout Muslim and living in a modern society. About 70% of Muslim immigrants go on to become U.S. citizens, compared with 50% of other groups. And almost 6,000 Muslims serve in the U.S. Armed Forces. Most of the tips about radicalized Muslims in the U.S. come from the Muslim community itself, the FBI says. On the whole, says Pew researcher Bashir Mohammed, Muslims have made a pretty significant embrace of American culture. Still, isn't radicalization a concern? Yes, especially in the internet age. And other terrorist groups have become skilled at using social media and videos to lure young men who are kind of living on the edge, said Andy Arena, former director of the FBI's Detroit office. Particularly ripe for recruitment are children of immigrants, such as Boston Marathon bombers Tamerlan and Zokar Tsarnaev, San Bernardino killer Saeed Rizwan Farouk, and Orlando shooter Omar Mateen. These second-generation Americans are sometimes confused about their cultural identity, anchored neither in the old or in the new, says former CIA Director Michael Hayden. They may find resolution of that conflict in intense religious devotion, which today can be drawn from extremist sources online. How extensive is the problem? Law enforcement sources estimate that 250 Americans have tried to join ISIS. That's far fewer than thousands who flocked to Syria and Iraq from European nations with large, poorly assimilated Muslim communities, which make for prime recruiting targets. One major difference is that American Muslims are relatively prosperous. But there is one poor community of Muslims in the U.S., the Minneapolis neighborhood dubbed Little Mogadishu, home to the nation's largest Somali community. One quarter of the American ISIS recruits have come from this community. Terror recruiters tell potential members, "We have for you money, wife, and power," said Mohammed Muhammad, director of Minnesota's Somali American Parents Association. A young kid who doesn't have enough mind to think, when he hears that, he goes. Will Muslims be accepted? That remains to be seen. Due to high birth rates, the number of American Muslims is expected to grow to about 8 million by 2050, eclipsing Jews as the second largest religious group in the U.S. But this age of terrorism and calls by Donald Trump and other politicians to ban Muslim immigrants or monitor Muslim communities have Muslims worried and in a defensive crouch. Many young Muslims say they encounter frequent anti-Muslim sentiment in schools and neighborhoods, and it's becoming more overt, not less. For 16-year-old Heb Jamal of New York City, being called a terrorist has been a way of life. Sometimes, she adds, you feel like the whole world is against you. It's exhausting. A Muslim majority in Michigan. The Detroit suburb of Hamtramck, Michigan, used to be 90% Polish American and overwhelmingly Catholic. But most of the Poles moved out after the struggles of the U.S. auto industry, and immigration from Yemen, Bangladesh, and Bosnia has transformed the blue-collar town of 22,000 residents into the nation's first majority Muslim community. It's also the first to elect a majority Muslim council. The transition was sometimes tense, beginning in 2004. The town gave a local mosque permission to broadcast the 6 a.m. call to prayer from loudspeakers. Some residents and anti-Muslim voices on the internet accused the council of planning to usher in Sharia law. But City Councilor Saad Al-Masmari says he represents all Hamtramck residents in accordance with local laws and the Constitution. It was a political election, not a religious one. His goal, he says, isn't to make the city more Muslim, but to bring more financial resources to the city. Polish-American Mayor Karen Majewski said that Hamtramck is a place where diverse people live next to each other, but not in some idealized kumbaya, Epcot Center kind of way. It sometimes gets contentious, but we deal with it. Moving into the columns now, I'm going to read four different ones for you this week, the first three coming from the U.S. First, the Saudis' involvement in 9/11. Now we know why the Bush administration wouldn't let the public see the infamous 28 pages detailing Saudi Arabia's connection to 9/11, said Simon Henderson. Those pages from a 2002 congressional investigation into 9/11 were finally released last week, and they are devastating. Investigators found strong evidence that some of the hijackers were in contact with and received support and assistance from individuals who may be connected to the Saudi government, including two Saudi intelligence officers. One of those men, Osama Basnan, received a significant amount of cash from a member of the Saudi royal family. When captured, Al-Qaeda leader Abu Zubaydah had in his phone book the unlisted number of a company that managed the Colorado home of Prince Bandar bin Sultan, the then Saudi ambassador to the U.S., and a Bush family friend. The report also concluded that members of the royal family had been funneling money to Islamic extremists. My own reporting back in 2002 found that Saudi princes were paying off Osama bin Laden to cause trouble elsewhere, but not in the kingdom. In response to the release of the report, the Saudis said there was no proof of any link to terrorists, and the matter is now finished. No, it isn't. The truth about who we are. This is not who we are. President Obama voiced those words of absolution after the racially motivated murder of five police officers in Dallas last week, just as he has done in the wake of so many mass shootings and ugly incidents throughout his tenure. That six-word phrase is the soothing balm that assures us the destroyers are aberrations, outliers. But in fact, America's seething mass killers, racists, and immigrant bashers are very much part of who we are. At the Dallas Memorial, Obama made an impassioned plea for racial unity, suggesting that we are inherently decent people who believe in coming together and making our country reflect the good inside us. Hordes of haters immediately accused him of being a race baiter, calling his heartfelt words disgusting and despicable. Donald Trump even suggested the president's body language communicated a secret hatred of police. The grim reality is that this country's racial divide remains vast. Millions of Americans do not question the prejudice in their heads and hearts, and they reject people who don't look, speak, or pray like them. It's time to face the uncomfortable truth and deal with what we are as a nation really are. Internet porn's no laughing matter. Liberals are sniggering at the plank of the Republican platform that calls pornography a public health crisis that is destroying the life of millions, said Judith Shulevitz. But before they dismiss this warning as puritanical nonsense from right-wing culture warriors, consider what the ubiquity of internet porn means for the 66 million Americans with children under 18. Our sons and daughters are being exposed to some very creepy ideas about how they're supposed to look and act. Today, when seventh graders are supposedly doing their homework on computers or texting friends, they may be actually watching a free gangbang video. Some of the fetish material online depicts rape, incest, women wearing diapers, and men having sex with corpses. Anyone who says it's up to parents to keep kids from seeing this material obviously has no idea how difficult it is to monitor every minute of a tween's or teen's internet use. Filtering software just doesn't work. And the average age of first exposure to online porn is now 11. So as the porn industry explores the darkest reaches of the human psyche in search of profits, liberals may want to rethink the assumption that only arch conservatives would try to stop their children from going there. In this column from Pakistan, Pakistan's biggest internet star has been murdered by her own brother, said Nirmalia Dutta. Kandil Baloch, 26, was famous across Asia as Pakistan's answer to Kim Kardashian. She shot to fame by posting risque selfies on social media. She didn't go nude like Kardashian, but the photos were daring by the conservative standards of her Muslim homeland. Baloch, an intelligent woman from a working-class family, was married off to an uneducated, abusive man at 17 and left him a year later, taking her son with her. She became so popular online that her earnings supported her parents. But dark forces opposed her. Last week, her brother drugged and strangled her, proudly confessing to the crime and saying she had dishonored the family. Most of the commenters on her Facebook page agreed, calling her a disgrace to Pakistan. I would call her instead a Pakistani women's activist as great as Malala Yousafzai. The young Nobel Prize laureate speaks out for girls' education while Baloch spoke out for women's right to control their own bodies, to wear what they please and marry whom they wish. Malala was shot for opposing the Taliban. Baloch was murdered for refusing to play by patriarchy's rules. We should honor her as a feminist pioneer. And the last word, our in-depth article, titled this week, The Strong Man Trump Wanted. For decades, Donald Trump has flipped between the political parties and offered conflicting stances on key issues, says journalist Robert Samuels and Sean Boberg. But he's consistently complained that America is weak. In October 1980, in his first major interview on network TV, Donald Trump sat on a couch in his Fifth Avenue apartment discussing the tough decisions he made as a builder. Then the 34-year-old abruptly turned the casual interview into something more controversial, a lecture on the lack of leadership in the U.S. Gas prices were soaring and inflation was rampant. More than four dozen Americans who had been kidnapped from the U.S. Embassy in Iran were being held hostage while, according to Trump, we just sit back and take everybody's abuse. I just don't feel the country is going forward in the proper direction. Barrett was taken aback by Trump's shift in to politics. Would you like to be president? She asked. No, he said. Politics was a mean life. Abraham Lincoln would probably not be electable today because of television. Trump said he knew people who would be excellent presidents because they were extraordinarily brilliant, very, very confident. None of them would seek the office because of the media scrutiny, which he called a tragedy. One man could turn this country around. The one proper president could turn this country around, he said. Trump would spend decades waiting for him. Since his rise as a businessman in the 1980s, Trump has shown few constants when it comes to politics, with one exception. He has tried to align himself with winners, people who could raise his profile and further his business goals. He's teetered back and forth between political parties and offered conflicting clues about his core beliefs, from health care to abortion rights. Trump has helped candidates on opposite ends of the political spectrum with money and endorsements, while often expressing concern that the country was losing its spirit and its stature. 7 years after Trump's Rona Barrett interview in the spring of 1987, Michael Dunbar, a furniture maker in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, tried to convince Trump that he was the man who could turn things around. The Republican Party activists had become fascinated by news reports about Trump's business acumen and personality. He sent out mailers encouraging Republicans to draft Trump. Friends told him the idea was laughable, but Dunbar invited Trump to speak at the local Rotary Club. Trump, intrigued, invited Dunbar to discuss the idea at Trump Tower that summer. The two devised a plan. Trump would fly his helicopter to a New Hampshire airfield, speak to the Rotary crowd at Yoakin's restaurant, and hold a news conference. A few weeks later, Trump took out full-page ads opining on foreign policy in three major newspapers. There's nothing wrong with America's foreign defense policy that a little backbone can't cure, he wrote in the ads, which cost a combined $95,000. He questioned why the U.S. continued to provide military funds to Japan and Saudi Arabia and implored, "Let's not let our great country be laughed at anymore." The image of the rest of the world laughing at U.S. leaders would become an enduring theme in Trump's political rhetoric. This time it came in the seventh year of Ronald Reagan's presidency, just weeks before the publication of Trump's book, The Art of the Deal, in which Trump called Reagan a smooth performer but questioned whether there's anything beneath that smile. On the day Trump's ads appeared, he told reporters that he would travel to New Hampshire. He was asked whether he was running for office. "There is absolutely no plan to run for mayor, governor, or United States senator," an unidentified spokesman replied. "He will not comment about the presidency." On October 22, 1987, Trump's helicopter landed at a New Hampshire airfield, where a limo paid for by Dunbar ferried Trump to a Yoakin's restaurant. There, a waiting crowd held placards that read, "Vote Trump for President and Vote for an In Trump Tenure." In his talk, Trump reprised themes from his ads, but he then told the assembled reporters, "I am not interested in running for president." Trump's brief flirtation with a run for office was over, but he reveled in the curiosity about his emerging political ambitions. Promoting his book, he would continually repeat his stances on issues such as trade. "This sounds political, like political presidential talk to me," Oprah Winfrey told Trump when he appeared on her talk show in 1988. "I probably wouldn't do it," Trump said, "but I do get tired of seeing what's happening with this country. And if it got so bad, I would never want to rule it out totally." A few months later, Trump attended his first Republican convention as George H.W. Bush accepted the party's nomination. During an interview on CNN, talk show host Larry King asked Trump why he was there. Trump said he wanted to see how the system works. Trump, who boasted of his wealth, cast himself as a man of the people. "You know, wealthy people don't like me because I'm competing against them all the time, and I like to win. The fact is, I go down the streets of New York, and the people that really like me are the taxi drivers and the workers." "Then why are you a Republican?" King asked. "I have no idea," Trump said. "I'm a Republican because I just believe in certain principles of the Republican Party." Trump became a vocal supporter of Bill Clinton in the late 1990s. "I think Bill Clinton is terrific," Trump said, December 27, 1997, on CNN. "I think he's done an amazing job. I think he's got the toughest skin I've ever seen, and I think he's a terrific guy." 1 month later, reports surfaced that Clinton had had a secret sexual relationship with an intern named Monica Lewinsky. Trump was unperturbed. "The best thing he has going is the fact that the economy's doing great," Trump said in August 1998, days after Clinton finally admitted a relationship with Lewinsky. Trump suggested that if he were a candidate, he would face similar controversy. "You think about him with the women? How about me with the women?" As a new election approached, Roger Stone, Trump's longtime lobbyist, examined the potential field, led by Republican George W. Bush and Democrat Al Gore. Stone said that this could be Trump's moment and that the path forward might be within a third party. Ross Perot, a Texas billionaire with no political experience, had won nearly 19% of the vote in 1992. And Jesse Ventura, a professional wrestler, had improbably won the governorship of Minnesota in 1998 on the Reform Party ticket. On October 8, 1999, Trump announced on Larry King Live that he was leaving the Republican Party to join the Reform Party and was forming an exploratory committee to run for president. He made a U-turn on Clinton, calling the previous 4 years disgusting and professing Reagan as his role model. Trump said his main competitor for the Reform Party nomination, Pat Buchanan, was too divisive. Who, King asked, would Trump pick as his vice presidential candidate? Trump named Oprah Winfrey. Although he called himself conservative, Trump was floating many liberal ideas. In The Advocate, a gay-oriented news magazine, he took issue with how Buchanan talked about Jews, blacks, gays, and Mexicans. Trump called himself a conciliator, saying he would extend the Civil Rights Act to include protections for gay people and would allow them to serve openly in the military. Trump also called for universal health care and the protection of Social Security through a one-time tax on the super wealthy and new money generated by renegotiating trade agreements. Trump's quasi-campaign traveled to Minnesota for a January 2000 meeting with his role model, Ventura, and Ventura's campaign staffers. Dean Barkley, who had chaired Ventura's campaign, advised Trump, "Just be honest. It's not what you say, but how you say it. And talk to the public, not at them." But Trump eventually chose not to run. On February 19, 2000, he wrote an op-ed in the New York Times in which he said that his exploratory campaign was the greatest civics lesson that a private citizen can have, but he was not sure a third-party candidate could win. Although Trump had already pulled out of the race, his name remained on the Reform Party ballot in Michigan and California. He won both primaries. Trump changed parties seven times between 1999 and 2012, starting when he left the GOP to consider a run under the Reform Party banner. After registering as a Democrat in 2001, he switched back to the Republicans in 2003. He became a Democrat again in 2005 and a Republican in 2009. He chose not to be affiliated with any party in 2011. Asked what he would say to critics who saw the constant party switching as proof that he had no core beliefs, Trump responded, "I think it had to do more with practicality, because if you're going to run for office, you would have had to make friends." Then he returned to the GOP in 2012, once again stoking speculation that he had his sights set on the presidency. Trump's celebrity status promptly put him among the 2012 frontrunners. An April 2011 survey of early primary state GOP voters showed him tied for second place behind Mitt Romney. Among Tea Party supporters, Trump led the field, and his positions became more aligned with conservatives. Now he was against abortion and no longer advocated making gays a protected class. He bashed Obama with an intensity he had never displayed with his predecessors. He called the president's signature health care law a job killer. He drew wide attention for focusing on the long discredited assertion that the president had been born not in Hawaii, but in Kenya. Obama put his birth certificate on public display and ridiculed the real estate mogul days later at the annual Black Tie White House Correspondents Association dinner, joking that Trump could now turn his attention to whether the United States had faked the moon landing. The audience roared with laughter while Trump looked on stone-faced, although he later insisted the evening was phenomenal. 2 weeks after the dinner, Trump announced that he would not run, saying that business is my greatest passion and I am not ready to leave the private sector. On February 2, 2012, he endorsed Romney and became an outspoken surrogate. On Election Day, Trump went to Boston to attend what he expected to be a Romney victory party. Romney's loss made him livid. "If only the candidate had used him more," Trump said, "Romney would have been a winner." Trump took to his increasingly favored medium, Twitter, to vent his frustration. "This election is a total sham and a travesty. We can't let this happen. The world is laughing at us." The world is laughing at us. It was the same concern Trump had from his first interview with Rona Barrett, when he said one proper president could turn the country around. Now a full-fledged celebrity, Trump was certain who that man might be. After Romney's loss, Republican elders huddled to create ways to transform the GOP into a younger, more inclusive party with new ideas. Trump was forming a different plan. 12 days after the 2012 election, he filed an application with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. He wanted to trademark an old phrase from Reagan, "Make America Great Again." This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post. On the health and science page now, the surprising benefits of thumb sucking. Kids are often urged to stop biting their nails or sucking their thumbs because their fingers are teeming with germs. But new research suggests these bad habits could actually reduce children's risks of developing allergies, reports the Washington Post. The findings support the hygiene hypothesis of allergies, which contends that exposure to microbes early in life educates and strengthens the immune system, When kids aren't exposed to enough germs, that priming process doesn't occur, and their immune systems overreact to new substances. Researchers in New Zealand put this theory to test by monitoring the oral habits of more than 1,000 children from birth to adulthood and conducting skin prick tests to identify those who suffered from allergies. They found that 49% of those who weren't thumb suckers or nail biters as kids eventually developed allergies to things like pets, grass, and dust mites. But allergies were found in only 31% of those who both bit their fingernails and sucked their thumbs when they were younger, and in 38% of those who did one or the other. The study's author, Malcolm Sears, said that doesn't mean parents should encourage kids to bite their nails or suck their thumbs. What we're saying is don't be quite so afraid of a little bit of dirt. Monkeys who use tools. Wild capuchin monkeys in Brazil have used stone tools to prepare their food for at least 700 years, new research reveals. Archaeologists discovered dozens of stone hammers and anvils in Brazil's Serra da Capivara National Park, the oldest known tools not belonging to either humans or chimpanzees. Operating carefully so as not to strike their own fingers, the monkeys use smaller stones as hammers to crack open cashew nuts on a heavier, flat stone. When they're done eating the protein-rich nut meats, they store their tools in nearby caches for future use, like a set of utensils at a restaurant. Scientists observed older monkeys teaching their youngsters how to use the stones. Carbon dating at the site indicates this cashew processing dates back at least 100 generations and probably goes back much further. When these monkeys arrived in the northeast Brazil about 500,000 years ago, they may have developed this system in order to subsist on hard-shelled fruits and seeds in the arid region. It may be that part of the reason the capuchins were able to colonize this area is that they found a technological solution, stone tool use, to overcome these plant defenses, the study's leader, Michael Haslam, tells the Los Angeles Times. The researchers speculate that prehistoric people might have learned to eat cashews by watching the capuchins crack open the tough shells. On the Talking Points page, the Iran deal 1 year later. It has been exactly a year since the signing of the Iran nuclear deal, yet even its most ardent apologists aren't celebrating the anniversary, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. Why not? Although Tehran has fulfilled its obligation to dismantle most of its nuclear infrastructure, it hasn't shown any sign of softening its rogue state behavior. In the last 12 months, the Islamic regime has launched several ballistic missile tests, violating the spirit, if not the letter, of a UN resolution, and continued to sponsor terrorism and prop up Syria's murderous dictator, Bashar al-Assad. Tehran has also been caught by Germany's intelligence agency trying to illegally obtain nuclear technology. President Obama let Iran regain $100 billion in frozen assets in the hope it might push the country in a more moderate direction. He has made a giant gamble and lost. The nuclear deal is fragile at best, said Robin Wright in NewYorker.com. The moderate Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani, gathered enough support for the deal only by convincing voters that nuclear diplomacy would lift sanctions and improve the economy. But the sanctions aren't being dismantled as quickly as he'd hoped. Although oil production and exports have dramatically increased, unemployment remains high, and major foreign companies have been reluctant to invest. That's because the West isn't playing ball, said Saeed Kamali Degan in TheGuardian.com. Iran remains locked out of the global financial system. Most European banks refuse to do any business with the country. And the Republican-controlled House has voted to block Iran's $20 billion deal to buy Boeing passenger jets. Nearly three-quarters of Iranians now believe they haven't benefited from the deal and that Washington will renege on its promises. If Rouhani loses next year's election, his successor may be his predecessor, the anti-Western hardliner Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Pokemon Go, why it's a worldwide craze. To the outside world, they might just look like any other 21st century human beings, said Tom Leonard in DailyMail.com. Stumbling around, head down, lost to the real world in the screen of their mobile phone. But the parade of zombies currently inhabiting our streets and public spaces aren't your usual social media addicts. They are devotees of Pokemon Go, a new Nintendo augmented reality mega hit that has become an international sensation and the biggest mobile game in U.S. history. For the uninitiated, said Haley Tukuyama in the Washington Post, Pokemon Go invites players to hunt for digital Pokemon on their smartphones, using the device's GPS and camera to make cute cartoon critters pop into existence alongside real-world physical objects. But the hunt to catch them all is causing major headaches for authorities. Poke addicts have wandered into the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C., and two men suffered injuries when they followed their smartphones off a cliff in Encinitas, California. As a Pokemon addict myself, I can tell you the game is an incredible amount of fun, said Mike Isaac in the New York Times. It not only provides a brief respite from the nonstop series of widely broadcast tragedies, but unlike other computer games, it gets me off my couch. I'm out in the parks with throngs of people of all ages, climbing over hills, making new friends. How pathetic, said Liz Jones in DailyMail.com. The last thing the world needs is another reason for adults to spend hours staring at their phones. When you see throngs of people blindly stumbling around our streets, it's as though these big Japanese corporations are performing a lobotomy on the populace. You Pokemon nerds remind me of those people in the Matrix, drip-fed images to keep us docile. Ah, it's time for another overblown panic about social decay, said Amanda Marcotte in Salon.com. Before Pokemon Go, people were wringing their hands over Harry Potter. Before Potter, it was rock and roll. Fact is, the only thing really significant about the Pokemon Go craze is that it means the technology of augmented reality, which overlays virtual images on our real worlds, has officially arrived. Chill out, Neo-Luddites. Pokemon Go is a fun phone game, not the end of life as we know it. Clinton, a wounded candidate. Hillary Clinton and her campaign team should be freaking out, said Kelly Riddell in the Washington Times. Throughout June and July, the mainstream media told us the presumptive Democratic nominee had this election wrapped up, that her Republican presidential rival, Donald Trump, had no campaign strategy, no money, and no chance of winning in November. But a flurry of new polls suggest a dramatic turnaround since FBI Director James Comey blasted Clinton for using a private email server. Trump is now beating Clinton in the battleground states of Florida and Pennsylvania, according to Quinnipiac polls, while a New York Times CBS News poll has the pair tied 40-40 nationally. The Real Clear Politics .com polling average has her lead shrinking to 2.7 points. Worse, Hillary has lost ground despite Trump's struggle to stay on message, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. A poll bump from the GOP convention could put Trump ahead. With 4 months to go, this race is one that can be won by either candidate. But the polls aren't finding that more Americans can support Trump, said Philip Bump in the Washington Post. Instead, they show support for Clinton sinking. Clinton's already low favorability rating has dropped 5 points since Comey called her extremely careless in her handling of sensitive emails, and her honesty and trustworthiness ratings have plunged 7 points. Can Trump reel in those disaffected Clinton voters? That's a much bigger question. It's more likely Clinton's unpopularity will hurt her in other ways, perhaps pushing voters toward a third-party candidate like Libertarian Gary Johnson, who is polling unexpectedly high at 13%. At this early stage, the state of the polls really doesn't matter compared to the four-lane pileup that is the Trump campaign, said Jeet Heer in NewRepublic.com. Clinton's 40% rating probably represents the low point of her campaign, but Trump has struggled to poll any higher than that. And his bizarre behavior and racist rhetoric mean he has little chance of convincing those who aren't already on board to support him. This is still Hillary's race to lose, said Michael Tomosky in thedailybeast.com. But she'd better make no more big blunders. The country and the world are depending on Clinton to send the utterly unqualified, unstable GOP nominee back to his gold-plated throne in Trump Tower. Don't screw this up. And some shorter notes. Despite several high-profile police and mass shootings, Americans are living in one of the safest periods in recent history. Since 1991, the murder rate has plummeted to a record low of 4.5 murders per 100,000 people, down from a high of 10.2 in 1980. There is about half as much violent crime in the U.S. today as there was 25 years ago. About half of Americans who work 50-plus hours a week say they don't take all or most of their vacation they've earned, a new poll found. Of those who do take vacations, 30% say they do a significant amount of work while on holiday. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.